Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by SDR Pods. Learn how we can build you a fully equipped sales development team to execute on personalized multi-channel prospecting and book you more meetings at the link below. Every sales org does things a little differently. Leaders pick up bits and pieces of best practices learned from books, experience in past roles and past companies, from their company's playbooks. But what if there was one easy process that could put all the others to shame? According to one sales expert, if you're not putting these simple sales processes to use, you're losing, in his words, an eye-watering amount of money. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks, and today on the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting to an expert about the four-pillar sales process that generated $10 million in revenue. The press refers to him as a young CEO disrupting the sales consultancy industry because he's non-traditional in his approach. He believes you have to have skin in the game in order to change a business's life cycle and achieve optimal sales performance. At the tender age of 22, he was the commercial director at Nobly POS, where he broke company records while heading up teams in Austin, Texas, and Uruguay. And now, as a co-founder at GrowthStream, he has generated over $10 million in sales for his clients. Kieran O'Connor, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this conversation. We're the same age. I'm saddened to know how much you've accomplished already in your life. I'm so proud. I think it's so wonderful. And you just have such an incredibly impressive resume for someone of your age. I mean, half the sales leaders I'm speaking to are kind of like, you know, they're kind of in the middle, they're in the stride of their career and they're 50 odd. And so it's incredible that you are where you are right now. So before we get into actionable tactics, give us kind of your abridged history and how you got here.
If it helps, I'm going to be 25 on Saturday. So that, there you go. But yeah, I guess I'll take it back a little step. You know, a lot of people assume because I've achieved so much so young that I almost come from a background of money or success or almost been sort of born with a silver spoon in my mouth, so to speak. Whereas if you kind of take it back, really, when I was at school, a lot of people will see from the news articles people write about me and talk about is I actually really struggled. You know, when I was at school, I wasn't academically smart. And I was given predictable grades of kind of U's, E's, S. You know, it wasn't an easy start. To kind of backtrack, I guess, to give the listeners some context, I grew up in a place called Norfolk, which not many people even know in England, never mind anywhere else. It's a small city near Norwich, which is called Bungay. And ultimately, you know, it was a normal upbringing, nothing special. I went to this school, it was very much average, but really, really struggled from an early age. Later down the line, you know, it worked out that I was very much suffering from dyslexia and just wasn't very good academically from a school standpoint. So it wasn't the funnest start. And it was really sort of fast forward and age of 15 where it really sort of started to come together, really. It was that age where you get your predictable GCSE grades. I don't know if it's still the same now, but you're given your predictable grades. And what I quickly realized at a young age that I was never going to learn the traditional way of sitting in front of a classroom, you know, and writing notes and then learning. So it was really the age of 15 where I started my journey, really. Once I understood dyslexia and where my weaknesses were, I started to understand where I could learn. And for me, it was doing what I would call practice tests. So you'd go away, you'd do a test, you'd see what you got wrong, and then you'd memorize it and keep learning. So at the age of 15, I kind of clocked that myself after getting in trouble for the last sort of 10 years at school and really spent that year learning my way rather than the kind of school system way. So, you know, between 9 and 3, I'd do it the school system way. And then in the evening, I would do it my way and subsequently came out with C's and B's, which, you know, isn't amazing to some people's standards, but for someone who's predicted sort of U's, E's and F's, it wasn't bad. So that really kickstarted my sales career, really. You know, I came out of school and realized that, you know, there's no point going to university. I don't learn in a classroom environment. What am I going to do? And you hear this a lot and it's a bit cliche, but I almost sort of fell into sales in a way that it was a job that was available straight out of school. And it was quite easy to get, let's be honest. You know, most people can get a sales job starting from the bottom and making their way up if they want to. So yeah, started at the age of sort of 16, 17 in the early days in the Swinton insurance game. So to kind of give you a bit of context, it was very much comparison websites. You would go online, get a comparison on car insurance. That would come through to me. My job would be to upsell you, cross-sell you. Just loved it. You know, just loved it from the day dot, really. You know, it was something that just really resonated with me. I got a bit obsessed with it from very early on. The call center was open 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. And I realized that the longer I stayed, the more money I could make, really. So that was the early days. You know, quickly became top sales guy there. And then when the changes came into play, I decided that I'd kind of hit a ceiling and decided to go on to the next venture, which was software as a sales, you know, SaaS sales, that most people would know it as, at the age of 18. And I guess part of this journey kind of going into what I'd call phase two was learning how to take a step back, which is a lot of the time people don't like to do these days. You know, people are very entitled and they think, you know, constantly look for that higher paycheck. Where when I went to software as a sales, software as a service sales, I realized I had no experience. Therefore, they wouldn't pay me what I was previously earning. So I actually started a company called EasePos Now as a sales development rep. And I had to start on 16 grand base salary. For a lot of people, would be quite shocking, really, because I was used to earning sort of 3, 4, 5 grand a month salary. So having to take that drop was a massive, massive thing for me and actually really set me up for success long term, because it taught me to take a step back and almost eat your pride a bit. Started there as a sales development rep at the age of sort of 18, became the top sales development rep within sort of 2 months, really. And then they realized that your skill set, you need to be in sales, you need to be in a 360 sales role. So got promoted to 360 sales role and subsequently got pay rises back to back quarters, 4 quarters in a row, and became their top sales guy, doing 1.8 million in sales while I was there. And then was sent on a plane to Orlando at the age of 20. Long story short, they had an operation that they'd scaled into Orlando and they'd give me the opportunity to go over there. Now, something that I talk about a lot is what I could control. So I realized that I had never been to America, never sold in the American market. So I took 2 weeks off, and instead of taking them 2 weeks off to do the typical, you know, go and get drunk and go out to clubs, I understood the market like the back of my hand. I'd done demonstrations with every competition. I understood their pricing model, how they sold, why they sold. So by the time I actually landed in Orlando, within month one, I was top sales guy doing 50,000 in new sales. So it was very much fast tracking my career again on an international stage, became top sales guy. And continue to be top sales guy throughout my time there. It was only the fact that the visa restricted me from staying any longer that I decided it was time to move on. From there, I decided that I wasn't going to go back to sleepy Norwich and that I wanted to go on and challenge myself in London. So I was then subsequently headhunted to go to a company called Nobly, as you mentioned earlier. And I started off as a sales manager and quickly made my way up to commercial director. At the age of 22, leading companies in UK, Austin, Texas, and Uruguay, and become one of the fastest growing tech companies out there. So hopefully that gives people a bit of a background.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. How did you manage to do that all so quickly? What is it about you that made you able to do all of that?
Yeah, so I don't think there's anything specifically that I have that other people don't have. It was simply sacrifice and determination. Now, a lot of people talk about what they want to achieve, and you hear the kind of saying a lot is don't run before you can walk. And I think the biggest thing that I found really skyrocketed my career was moving out. I moved out at the age of 17. I really moved out of my comfort zone, which pushed me harder because I had bills to pay and I didn't have that kind of blanket behind me. So first thing I would always recommend is move out as soon as possible and push yourself outside your comfort zone. And then sacrifice is number two. You know, I didn't go on holiday for 10 years. I didn't do the typical wait for the weekend and get drunk every weekend, which played into why I could fast track my career, really. So the biggest advice that I could give to anyone is I haven't got anything special. It's just simply that I was willing to give up the things to achieve the goals.
Mm-hmm. I think that's something that obviously makes sense. And young people specifically tend to have the kind of want or the need to go out and experience new things and do the getting drunk and do the partying and all that kind of thing. And I think it's so much easier said than done to kind of give that all up. Is there some kind of tip, or was there like a big picture you were thinking of? How did you justify to yourself, like, okay, I'm not gonna have fun. I'm not gonna do these things that maybe a lot of my friends and my peers are doing. How did you manage to make yourself do that?
Well, look, the biggest, I guess, quote that I heard when I was younger from some of the most successful people in the world that I almost looked up to was, you've got to ask yourself a question. Are you interested or are you committed? And as soon as I heard that, that resonated with me, because I realized that hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, are interested in achieving their goals and interested in buying big houses and interested in buying fancy holidays and cars. But are they committed? No. And that was going to be the difference between me and the rest of the market. So I realized from a young age that you can't have your cake and eat it, so to speak. And it was either short-term gratification or long-term thinking. And I kept that long-term thinking because I knew that if I continued to work the way I was working, it would pay off eventually, which would see me have a better life long-term than for that short gratification.
Interesting. Well, if you're listening right now, whatever role you're in, ask yourself that question. Are you interested or are you committed? I think that's a very, it's kind of an encapsulating question that kind of boils it down to two very fine points. And I haven't heard it put like that, but yeah, it totally makes sense. So in order for you to have learned everything that you learned over such a short period of time, you must have been actively seeking out new information. You mentioned you took those 2 weeks off before moving to Orlando to learn. So you must have been doing that kind of at an incredible pace just in your day to day. What did you do? What kind of steps did you take each day to gain all the knowledge that you have now?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. It's something I talk about on a daily basis. Self-development is the key for me and has been the key throughout my journey. It's going after that information and not waiting for it to come to you. We are more connected now than ever before. There is no excuse now to not go and get information and better yourself on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. You know, you've got YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, books, podcasts, and so on and so on. So for me, it was, again, breaking down my daily habits, but thinking long-term again. So a lot of people treat their job as a job. I treated my job as a business, and I looked at what did I need to achieve in that business, or if you like, job, to achieve my goal. And you weren't always going to get the answers internally, and you weren't always going to grow as fast as you could internally. So you need to go and seek that information. So for me, daily would be 5 to 10 pages a day of a book. Now, again, I wasn't a massive reader back then. So again, it was taking it gradual. And then from there, it was seeking out people that achieved what I wanted to achieve and going and learning from them people. And you hear it a lot, but it is so true. Going and offering them something in return for their time. If you haven't got the money, then see what you can do for them in return rather than just the money. So my biggest advice is put together a structure, month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months of self-development. But you've got to link something to that. Why are you doing that? Because a lot of people kind of, they do a week or 2 weeks and then they're like, oh, I'm bored, or I can't keep to it, or I'm busy. It's because they haven't linked a goal to that reason.
Okay. And to chat further about speaking to people who have achieved what you're looking to achieve, would you be looking at people within the company that you're working for, or broader than that? How do you find and get in contact with that type of person?
Yeah, both. I mean, if they are in the company, then you've got a head start, right? You just need to approach them and have that conversation. For example, if you're in sales and there is a top sales guy, then the obvious thing is to go and listen and look at what they're doing. Now, a lot of the time, they sometimes won't be willing to give you that information because they're taking their time up. So you need to be able to offer them something in return. Mm-hmm. If it's not internally, then there's so much resource externally. You know, there's so much now, the internet, YouTube, LinkedIn. Let's just look at LinkedIn. It's so easy now to find people that have achieved what you want to achieve, go and connect with people, interact with people. But the biggest problem people do is they go in with, help me, help me, help me. Mm-hmm. And you need to go in with very much engaging with that person, but also offering them something in return.
So I'm thinking from the mind of kind of like a first-time SDR, or first-time sales rep who, like you, maybe wouldn't have come with the resources. They don't necessarily come from money. It's their first sales job. They haven't made a lot of money yet. So what are the types of things that somebody in that kind of stage of their life can offer one of these top performers as that value add for them?
Yeah, well, for example, let's say that they've got a pipeline of people that haven't been able to get hold of. You know, let me call all them leads for you. Let me do something for you. Let me do all of them emails for you. Let me file them emails for you. Let me do that meeting for you that you don't want to do. There are so many things that they can do in return that just gives value and actually shows. And for me, why I don't like free is because you've got no skin in the game, as you mentioned earlier, that why would I give my resource and my time that's took years to get and hours of my time and sacrifice to someone that's not willing to do one thing for me? Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, if you haven't got the money, then of course there are things like podcasts, YouTube and things like that. But internally, you just go and offer that person and ask for just 15, 20 minutes of their time. Or even better still, that you could do is just ask for them to send you a call that they felt was good that you could then listen to, which doesn't take any of their time up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think SDRs, sales reps listening right now, that's a great tip. We've heard before, you know, have these conversations with people internally that are great at their job. But yes, as you're saying, Karen, it's absolutely vital that you're offering something in return to that person, because maybe that means even further down the line, they'll want to help you again. You can have kind of consistent back and forth there. And so the types of things you can offer are taking something off their plate. I think that's a great example. Maybe they don't want to bang through those 20 cold calls that they don't think the people are even going to pick up the phone. Maybe they don't want to have to answer all the no thank you emails and schedule, you know, the follow-ups a couple of months from now. So see what you can take off their plate. And I'm sure they'll be happy to share with you a great call or great tips or a great sequence that they use or something like that.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about GrowthStream. Give us a little kind of just background on the company itself, but specifically, I'd love to hear what makes you different from other sales consultancies.
Yeah, so the story kind of sort of give you a bit of context for the audience as how GrowthStream came about is, you know, at the age of 22, I started to look at why could I consistently build high performing sales teams. Now, of course, everyone can look at the work ethic and the attitude and the self-development, of course, but there is hundreds of thousands of people that also do that. So I wanted to find out the core reasons as to why my teams were successful, which kind of led me to look at the foundations of them teams. And it was myself and my business partner, Costa Coisi. We actually were in Uruguay at the time, and we started to write down what made our team successful from the ground up. And that's really where we came up with our four-pillar process. And then we were like, you know what, we're going to do it. So within 24 hours, we had flown back to the UK, took an apartment that we never saw, with two suitcases and our laptops. And that was back in September 2018. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we formulated this four-pillar process, which is your structure, touchpoint process, follow-up and follow-back. But to answer your question specifically on what makes us different, we go into these businesses and we tie our revenue to their revenue and their results, which means for them, not only are they getting someone that's very experienced, has a lot of knowledge, but also their risk is so much lower because they're only paying if they get the results. And there's a lot of consultancy companies out there that work on hourly rates or work on coaching rates, but they're not tied to anything specifically. You have to pay for their time and their knowledge, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. I think conceptually we can all understand that, of course, having your skin in the game means that you're going to be more committed, but why do you really think it makes such a difference that that's how you run your sales consultancy?
Well, because you not only do you invest your time, but you invest your, you know, energy, time, but also it's looking at how you basically become an extension of their sales team, an extension of their team, because you are one. If you are, for example, paying for an hour with me, you have an hour and you pay for that. And they make their money regardless of what they gave you in that hour. And you pay that money regardless of what they give you in that hour. For us, we knew and we know with our clients that we will have to do anything possible and everything possible to get them results. Otherwise, we won't get paid a fair share of our money. And what that creates is that's an all-in-one process, because you become a lot more interlinked with that business and client and then a lot more obsessed with their end goals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you mentioned a really strong foundation when building a sales team is of the utmost importance. That's what you and your partner kind of nailed down as the key to building these really successful sales teams. You've obviously seen that in your experience building these sales teams and existing in sales teams for many years before actually starting GrowthStream. So before we actually break down that four-pillar process, give us some examples of how you've built that foundation for some of your clients.
Yeah, so without sort of going in depth in each four areas, first of all, we always go in and we do what we call a sales audit. So it's looking at the four areas that we'll discuss and the four key areas in them businesses proactively. We don't sit remote. We go very much internally. We sit with the sales team. We sit with their business and we look at their statistics. We look at their data. We look at their CRM. We look at everything as a whole. So we actually understand specifically with that client what is going on. It's not a one size fits all approach. Mm-hmm. It is very much specific to that business. We abstract all of that information and we start to look at how we formulate to get them to their goal. So that could be a 1 month, 2 month, 3 months and so on strategy, but with the end goal in mind of what that client is looking to achieve, which will then tie in how we make our money.
Right. Got it. So kind of the very first step that you'll take when working with any new client is this audit where you just take a deep look at absolutely everything that's going on. And it's from there that you can start to implement this four pillar process.
Yeah, definitely. But also it allows you to open up and challenge areas that they didn't even think of or look at where you can add value and ultimately make them money.
Okay, perfect. Well, then let's dig into the four pillar process. That's what everybody's here for. It's the title of the episode. We know it's the thing that's going to make them an eye-watering amount of money. So let's tell them how to do it. So you mentioned that the kind of four parts, the four pillars are structure, touch points, yep. Follow up, and then follow back, as you call it. So let's dig into those. I know you mentioned to me offline that you think there are a couple that are particularly poignant or particularly important these days in the kind of current sales or business landscape. So yeah, give us those and let's dig into it.
Yeah, so if we start with structure, it sounds so simple. And a lot of these strategies that I give do sound so simple, but yet so effective. Now, what I employ anyone who's listening is go and implement these and look at your results over a period of time. They sound simple, but I promise, implement them. So starting with structure, we're obviously looking at inherently, let's be honest, salespeople are very busy and not very organized. So what we start to look at is what is your maximum output on a daily basis? So if you actually start to go into teams now, sales teams, sales organizations, a lot of them don't have a clear structure. So you can break this down in different ways, but the easiest way to explain it for you guys is simply, how much time are you spending prospecting? How much time are you spending in meetings? How much time are you spending on admin? So you need to start looking at finder, keeper, doer, if you like to explain it like that. And you need to start breaking down your day to make sure that you're using your time to the optimum value. Biggest problem we find in today's society is people start at 9 o'clock. They'll go and get a coffee. They'll gossip about the day before, the night before. They'll then check their phones. They'll then have meetings about meetings, and suddenly your day gets away from you. And actually, really, you've achieved not a lot. So your productivity level is at an all-time low these days. Mm-hmm. So what we start to look at is, let's use a client that I worked with recently. They looked at, well, why were we having so many unable to contact leads? And why was our call volume decreasing on a daily basis? So what we did is we went in and we understood, well, when is the best time to get hold of your leads? Now, if you've got data from your CRM, great. If you know the industry even well, of course, you factor that in. So we realized we knew between 9 and 11 a.m. was a good time, 1 and 3, and it was 5 and 6:30. So what we did is we broke down three core calling hours, slots between the day. So we've got the morning slot, the afternoon slot, and what we call the evening slot. We knew, regardless of what else we did, we had three calling slots throughout the day to get hold of them leads and convert them to opportunities. Just by doing such a simple thing like that, we saw calls go from average to 40 to over 100. We saw the conversion rate go up to 65% lead to opportunity, and the unable to contact rate reduced to 15% from 50%.
Wow. How did such you figure thing. Out the time? How do you know when to have those three call blocks?
Well, you can look at your data, and if you haven't got your data, you have to do a bit of trial and error, right? But if you've got data, CRM such as HubSpot, Salesforce, things like that, you can look up your pickup rate, your talk time, when the leads are coming in versus when they're being converted. And you start to compile that data, and then you can start to look at them golden times. And of course, there will be some trial and error in there.
Sure. Okay, great. So structure, one of the kind of key pieces of structure is breaking out your day into organized blocks so that you're not kind of just performing all your tasks kind of ad hoc and then wasting time. And then a really important part of that is to figure out when your prospects are actually answering the phone so that you can make sure you're only calling them at that point rather than just having to mark them all not answered, not answered, not answered.
Exactly that.
Cool. So what's the next of your four pillars?
Absolutely. So once we've got the structure right, so we're understanding that we're utilizing our time effectively and every day that we're optimizing our value on a daily basis, then we start to look at our marketing spend. So we start to look at, and you will hear on a daily basis, marketing spend pre-COVID was at its highest level ever. more and more people were plowing money into inbound marketing, social media, events, and so on and so on. But no one was looking at their touchpoint process. Now, to give you a bit of context, 80% of businesses we go into, when you say to them, do you have a touchpoint process? They say, what does that mean? Now, to give people an idea of what it actually means is how many times you touch a lead to convert it to an opportunity. It's as simple as that. Now, if I ask their salespeople how many times you touch a lead to get hold of it on average, if they don't know the answer to that, especially as a sales manager, you have a problem. Mm. So what we start to look at is we start to formulate a clear touchpoint process that every single lead is handled effectively throughout the business. So again, give you a live example. We have one client that we realized that we're going to have a 7 working day touchpoint process strategy. We're going to call the lead 3 times a day in them 3 blocks that we talked about. Over a 7 working day period, they're going to get 1 voicemail and 2 emails mm-hmm. during that 7 working days, which means you've got 21 calls, a voicemail, and 2 emails throughout a 7-day working day block. And again, we start to trial that. And again, you can tweak it according to your data. But again, their statistics shot through the roof. Again, they converted more of them leads. They lost less money through what we'd call wastage in terms of leads. And their marketing spend was being used a lot more effectively. Again, simply by implementing such a simple structure. But that, alongside your daily structure, we'll see your figures go through the roof just in them 2 areas.
Yeah. So when you talk about marketing spend for this touchpoint process, the way I kind of understand what you described as the touchpoint process is it's like the sequence design. So it's the way you're gonna set up that campaign within whatever sales enablement tool like HubSpot, Outreach, whatever. But when you talk about marketing spend and kind of tying that into touchpoints, is that because the list you're getting is one that marketing has got for you through their
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of efforts?
So it's looking at, for example, let's say that your company is spending $50,000 a month on lead generation. So okay. That 50,000, how are you using them £50,000 worth of or dollars worth of leads to then convert them into opportunities? And what companies need to look at is how much are they losing due to unable to contact? That will tell you just there if you've got a touch point process. And then what you can look at is your how much your spend is on them unable to contact leads, which will obviously tell you how much you're losing in marketing spend.
Got it. Okay. So if there was a company that was doing outbound, this would kind of fall into the touchpoint process as well, right? You'd still
Absolutely.
Want to look at how to design that sequence, how many touchpoints it takes, but just filling the sequence instead with the cold non-marketing leads.
Absolutely. It works exactly the same way. It's how many times you touch on that prospect and you know, we'll go on to talk about follow-up in a minute, but it also plays into a follow-up process as well.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so to recap thus far, if you're listening, pen and paper out, do the thing that Kieran did when he was young, write it down, and then later go back and see if you can memorize it. If you get it wrong, do it again. So structure is the first thing, and that's yep. breaking out your day, figuring out exactly what time you're going to do what activities so that you're not wasting your time, and then touch points. And that is the sequence design. For those of you that use a sales enablement tool, it's designing that campaign, setting up day 1 email, day 2 call, day 3 so on and so forth. And the touch point process, you want that to be kind of corresponding with the data that you have on how long it usually takes for a prospect to respond or kind of which channels they usually respond through, so that you're optimizing that process rather than just randomly throwing out tasks and hoping that they're going to respond.
Exactly that.
Cool. Okay. What's next?
So we're on to the follow-up, what I call the dreaded follow-up, right? So now we've obviously got the front end right. So we've got our structure right. We know that we're working to our optimum. As you said, we now know that we've got the touchpoint process right, which has given us the best opportunity to get hold of them leads. Now we need to look at what happens once we get into an opportunity and we have an online demonstration, a meeting, a face-to-face meeting. Now, industry statistics last year was it was an average 5 follow-ups to close a deal. That's what it said in the UK. Now, the biggest problem that we have, and I guess we can kind of give a live scenario here, is, you know, I worked in EPOS, so we would do online demonstrations similar to this. We'd do a screen share and we would walk them through the software. Now, the biggest problem that people have is when they get to the end and they obviously get that objection and they say, call me next week, call me next month, call me the end of the quarter. It's like, absolutely, totally agree, fair enough, speak to them. And that's it. And it's a big problem in sales is people don't actually understand or isolate the follow-up. So the tips that I would give is once you finish a meeting, whether it be online, in person, however you decide to do your meetings, you need to understand, well, first, if there's an objection, you need to isolate it and understand why and deal with that accordingly. Number two, you need to agree the next steps. So when are we next going to speak? Or is that next going to meet? And you're going to put a time specifically in their calendar. So let's say next Thursday at 3 o'clock, you're going to send that calendar invite while they're either in the meeting or they're on the online meeting. Have them accept it. Then what you do is you send an email with a recap on what's going to happen between now and that follow-up meeting to agree the task and the action point. So again, it's isolate that objection, confirm when you're next going to speak and have them accept it, and then send the follow-up email. It's, again, sounds so simple, but yet so many people don't do it.
It's true. I've spoken to a couple of kind of sales leaders who had previously been account executives, who their focus really is on trying to share this kind of follow-up process, because there is so much content and so many podcasts and you know, so many thought leaders are posting on LinkedIn about how to get that first meeting and kind of the process of the prospecting or whatever leads up to that demo. But what do you do once you have the demo to make sure that it actually closes? And so much of that comes from this follow-up process, not what happens in the calls, but what happens in between, as you're saying, what's happening between now and next Thursday when we've got that follow-up booked? What are the kind of, what is the path that this will take if it's going to close and if it's going to be successful?
Absolutely. And I think it's something, again, as you rightly said, a lot of people don't focus on. They focus on getting the meeting and then they really let themselves down in the follow-up process. And again, the way you can look at this is you just need to go into your team's pipeline or your own pipeline and look at where in the process the deals are stalling. So is that in the follow-up? Is that once you've sent the quote? Really identify where your deals are stalling and then go and listen back to either that meeting or that demonstration or that phone call and understand what did you do wrong.
So how do you track this follow-up process? Is this another kind of follow-up touch point process that you would kind of set up a sequence in your automation software? Or is it something that you kind of have to just track your deals through your CRM and make sure that you're doing the follow-up? How do you, because some people might have a massive pipeline volume, massive deal volume. How can you make sure that you are doing this effective follow-up?
Yes, there's two ways you can do it. Obviously you can get your guys to automate it via your CRM. So when you finish a meeting and you click, you know, launch task update, meeting finished or meeting completed, it'll automatically allow you to set a follow-up for a specific time and date. So I know Salesforce, HubSpot, things like that, they can do that. Or again, you can take more of the manual route, whereas a manager, it's not the best route, but you can, when you are in one-to-ones or you have morning meetings, you are checking that there's a follow-up booked on every single opportunity in the pipeline. So there's two ways to do it. Again, I prefer the first one. It makes your life a lot easier. It saves you time. And let's be honest, we've got the technology to do it these days. But if you can't and you haven't got that CRM, again, all you need to do is look at the pipeline and look whether it's got a next step booked.
Yeah, absolutely. And follow-up has definitely got to be absolutely the most important thing. And so, yeah, I think if you're watching out there, put a little asterisk beside that point in particular. Follow-up is super important. As Kieran said, either get it set up in your CRM or in your sales enablement tool so that you can just have a prospect or a customer that just moves through the sequence and reminds you that you've got to do the next thing. But if you are going to have to do it manually, set up these one-on-ones and do a pipeline review with your manager, with your superior, so that you're kind of being held accountable to make sure that there is a next step that is set for every single meeting, for every single prospect, every single deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Okay. And then what is follow back?
Yeah. So the way I describe follow back, it's like, again, I'm not an F1 fan, but those who are, it's like Formula One, right? So similar to what we just discussed, you completed an online meeting, you completed a face-to-face meeting, but then something happens. Now we've all been there. Budget gets cut, priorities get moved, and it becomes more of what we would call a longer deal cycle, 3, 6, 12, 18 months and so on and so on. Now, the biggest problem is we are in pole position. We've got that pole position and then the lights change red, right? They've changed their mind or something happened. Now, of course, we need to isolate that objection and battle it accordingly. But if we can't, then we need to look at how we stay in pole position. Now, the biggest problem in sales today is people look at the low-hanging fruit and they look at the easy deals, but they don't want to look at them long-term deals. But actually, that's what gets you to the higher targets, the higher paychecks and the higher commissions, because you've constantly got a pipeline. Now, how we would describe it is, right, okay, you finished that meeting, you've isolated that objection, you've done the simple follow-up process that we just talked about, you've booked next steps, you've agreed on what needs to happen, and you need to keep following back with them. Now, don't just call them and go, hi, it's Kieran calling from GrowStream, I'd love to talk about your sales process. No, you're not ready. Okay, let me call you in 3 months, right? That's not the way we're saying to do it. You need to look at why you're calling them and the value that you're offering them in that phone call. So, for example, LinkedIn is great for this because you can comment, you can add value to them, you can send them ebooks, you can send them videos that they might find useful in the interim before you then next speak. But you need to make sure you're adding value throughout that whole process to keep your name at the forefront of their mind for when that light basically goes back to green. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem that we see is people are closing deals on no longer interested. Now, you start to then listen back to them calls and their meetings and realize they are interested. They're just not interested right now.
Right.
So you need to make sure that you're basically not handing deals to your competition, because if they're going to come back in that buying frame and you've already done all the hard work, you're just losing simple deals through being lazy. So again, it's using your sales enablement tools, it's using your Salesforce, it's using your one-to-ones to really understand, are you following back with these deals? Now, my longest deal was 2 years and it was my biggest deal that I've ever done. The only reason I won it wasn't because my product was superior. It wasn't because I had this objection handled in masterclass. It was simply because I stayed at the forefront of their mind and continued to add value throughout the journey, which meant they didn't go and look elsewhere.
Yeah. So in this case, what type of value? Obviously, if you're working for an organization, they probably produce a lot of content that is going to be valuable for the type of people you're prospecting. So I imagine you're employing some of that stuff as the value that you're adding. But what types of stuff are you sharing with that prospect to add value?
Yeah, absolutely. For example, if you're selling a product that, you know, is a solution to a problem, right? You need to look at what is that problem that they're having. And let's say that your software gets a new update. You get a new feature that could help fix that problem. There's a prime example. Or there might be an article that you saw online that you might find useful for them. It might not necessarily come from your company. That's okay. But it's constantly having a reason to speak to them, but with a value add, rather than just, hi, where are you at? Are you ready to buy? No, okay, I'll speak in a month. Hi, are you ready? It's employing all of the tools around you. Right. Okay. So you've got LinkedIn, you've got YouTube, you've got your marketing team strategy, you've got ebooks, you've got so many resources that you can continue to add value to them. And it might be that it's such a simple thing, but it still keeps you in the loop. Mm-hmm. So, go on, sorry.
No, you go on.
It was very much utilizing tools that people don't look at. For example, let's say LinkedIn, right? You can see that someone's looking for a product that they offer, tag them in it. Just things like that, simple things like that will keep your name at the forefront.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned it doesn't necessarily have to come from your company, because I think probably a lot of us are stuck in that loop of like, okay, I've got to share stuff, but I've got to share stuff that ultimately like points them towards buying from me. But you probably can gain so much more trust if you are sharing things that aren't even from your company, because then they know it's not with the like ultimate goal of like book a meeting, buy my product, buy my service. It's like, this is something that I genuinely think will help you. You may not turn around and come and buy from me as a result of this, but as you mentioned, you're kind of staying on the forefront, staying top of mind with them and constantly providing value, which goes back to what you mentioned about when you're trying to learn from people that are great at what they do. If anyone is going to continue to give you their time, they need that value in return. That's kind of it's a lesson, I think, across every aspect of sales that we're learning in this conversation.
No, absolutely. And I think the biggest problem that we have is we've all been there, right? You get a phone call and you look down at your phone and automatically if they think, oh, it's that sales guy wants to sell me that product that I don't want, you're done. As soon as you get to that point with your prospects, it's game over. Now, if they think, oh, it's, you know, it's Kieran, he's, you know, he's probably got a, you know, been up to something, or he's probably got some good ideas for you, might be able to help me with something. Suddenly you become a trusted advisor for multiple areas rather than just a product that you're trying to sell, which creates that trust. And again, like we said, it might be that they're looking for office space and you know an office broker that can help them connect them. Again, it's you're offering value in something that isn't buy, 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 buy. And then they know that, they know what you're trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something we had a guest on this podcast, Tom Abbott from SoCo. And he said, what you have to basically do is make yourself the expert in the field, in the field that is solving the problem that, you know, your company solves or whatever. So as you're saying, you become this thought leader or this trusted advisor over the course of time. And then they know when the time comes that they're like, ooh, I have this problem and I need it to be solved. They know to come to you to solve it. And that may eventually be, yes, buying your product. But yeah, absolutely. You've got to just provide value by being knowledgeable in that field that they're in.
No, definitely. I think it's a great point. And it's something that I talk about with every team that I go into. It's becoming an expert in your area. Mm-hmm. Now, not enough people do that. Not enough people actually become an expert and learn outside of their kind of niche. They look at everything. You know, when I sold EPOS, I understood the cost per acquisition, the turnover rate, how much it cost in wastage, how much it cost in stock management. I became an expert ultimately running a restaurant and a cafe. So when I had them conversations with my prospect, I already knew the pain points they were having.
Mm. Interesting. And I have another question that I wanted to go back to. You mentioned you don't want to be losing these deals because you're marking them lost when they're no longer interested. So when do you know that it's actually the right time to actually stop following up on a deal? When is a deal actually dead? How do you know?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's all down to, there's always going to be that personal opinion involved in it. But I think when you've got to the point where you followed up multiple times, you've objection handled multiple times, you've sent them value, you've sent them a quote, you've had multiple meetings, and they are just not interested. And you've had that frank conversation with them to say, look, you know, just be honest with me. Is this something you're realistically looking into? No. Or is this something you're going to look into in the near future? No. There's your answer. You've got to have them. If it gets to the point where you've done everything possible and you know it, and you've had that frank conversation, that will tell you. And they're conversations that I used to love having. You know, I used to get to the point where I was like, this guy's been in my pipeline so long, I just need to have this frank conversation and say, look, I'm going to stop the email, stop the phone calls, are you no longer interested? And half the time they're like, oh, I just didn't want to tell you, but no, I'm not, sorry, done.
There you go. So give them the opportunity to tell you rather have than assuming that it's finished. Because yep, you're probably going to lose out on some that aren't actually, that would be ready in a couple of months, but absolutely give them that opportunity to just take the out and then you get it straight from the horse's mouth.
Exactly. They don't feel as bad. You know, when you're frank with them and honest, you get the same in return, and that makes your life a lot easier. It stops you wasting time on them and they feel almost better because they don't have to keep lying to you and stringing you on.
Awesome. Well, do you have any last tips for any of our, you know, sales reps out there or sales leaders or people that are looking to kind of accelerate their career as you did? Any lasting words of wisdom that you want to impart on our listeners before we go?
Yeah, look, I think right now the easiest way to increase your sales right now and start to increase your conversion rate due to the pandemic, a lot of marketing budgets have been slashed, and I'm hearing a lot of sales leaders say, well, I can't hit the same targets, I've got less budget. I implore you to just go into your CRM as we speak, look at your close reasons and start to understand why you're losing them deals, and then start to put together a plan to start increasing your conversion rate and decreasing them closure reasons, which will make you more money, enable you to hit higher targets without having to spend any more money on marketing. So the way to do that is as simple as pull a report, understand how many deals on a monthly, quarterly, and yearly basis you're losing for that reason, put together an objection handling script, and then train your team on it and monitor it. So that's really straightforward, and that's the advice I'd give to a sales leader. If you're a sales exec right now, especially during the pandemic, you've got to understand that the simple fact is you're going to have to work harder than you ever have before to get the same results you were getting previously. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. That's sales and that's business. It's up and down. So I'd implore you to continue to learn, continue to utilize your resources throughout, you know, the internet, podcast, phone calls, whatever your medium is. But don't allow yourself to get into that mindset of it's a pandemic, everything's bad, business is bad, I'm not going to hit the same targets, and just become procrastinating and negative, because business is still happening. People are still making money. I recently just signed one of the biggest deals I've ever signed just last week. So don't allow yourself to listen to people. And then second to that, as a sales guy, surround yourself with winners. If you surround, and I don't want to be a bit corny here, but it's so true. If you surround yourself with winners, you will become one, because you will get ingrained into you their attributes into yourself. So that's my advice for pandemic side of things. And keep doing what you're doing. Implement these four touchpoint processes mm-hmm. that we talked about, and you'll be on to be a top sales team, just like we've been.
Nice. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Kieran. This has been incredibly interesting. There's so much value here for sales leaders down to sales reps, from kind of growing your career to these four pillars, the four pillar process as we chatted about. And then, yeah, some wonderful tips at the end. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. If people want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
Yeah, easiest way is LinkedIn, as usual. I will let them know my name is spelled K-I-E-R-E-N because my parents thought they'd make my life difficult. So it's Kieran O'Connor. Alternatively, just go to www.growthstream.co. Again, anybody who wants to learn more about the four pillar process, we have eBooks, we have videos, which are totally free of charge for them to look at. So I'd love to hear from them.
Nice. And you're actually launching a big business development event in London in October of next year. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's in the pipeline. We've got two major events coming up. So first, the first book's coming out in April next year, and then second, the big event. So anyone across the globe that loves self-development, we're going to bring one of the biggest events to London, which is going to implore sales, marketing, self-development, and health all in one big event. So again, if you want to get more information on that, head over to LinkedIn or the website, sign up to our newsletter, and we will add you, and we'd love to see you.
Nice. And lastly, you had something very lovely for our guests and our listeners. If you wanted to have a free discussion with Kieran about whether it's the four pillar process, whether it's about implementing any of the things we've chatted about on the podcast, he's offered very graciously that he would have basically a free chat with you guys. So if you want to schedule that, reach out to him on LinkedIn, as he said, and yeah, you'll get a conversation with an expert. How lucky.
Just tell where you've come from and what podcast you've listened to in terms of predictable revenue. That will obviously allow you to get that hour free. And anybody, any questions, I'd love to hear from you. Any strategies, any ideas around books, self-development ideas, and sales, please reach out and obviously mention predictable revenue.
Nice. Well, there you go, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode of Predictable Revenue Podcast. And thanks so much, Kieran O'Connor, for being my guest.
Thank you very much.